Yeah, thank you very much for letting me present this, which I've been working on. So all these papers are with Luca Nayagam, the IIS, or in Bangalore now, and Mukund Rangamani in Davis. And okay, so what's the problem we eventually want to solve, or why do we study hydrodynamics? So the real question is how to do low energy effective field theory, or how to do physics in general if there's some part of the system you don't know about, right? So you traced out some part of the system, or you focus on some effective low energy regime, something we do every day. Then, as I will try to argue, there are certain issues if you do that, because if the system is in some mixed state and you've done some RG on that, say, then there are features of the low energy, of the high energy theory that you should keep track of. So in particular, what I have in mind is something like Schwinger-Keldysh doubling, which I will define in more detail later on. But just schematically, if your system is in a mixed state, it means you described by some density matrix, so you have bras and cats, and it's not enough just to evolve states, but you need to keep track of bras and cats separately in some sense. So this introduces some doubling in your theory, some doubling of degrees of freedom. Something like this should be involved. This has been known since the 60s. And there are many applications for this, and it has been also known for a while that this is very powerful. And you've all seen this picture, which is perhaps the most interesting situation for me personally that we eventually hope to make to understand it. But of course, these things, this is about gravity and all these things, which is a different level of complication. But I want to explain what we think there's some structure which should be important, and which we can make very precise in the context of hydrodynamics. Okay, that's the main motivation to study hydrodynamics here, because certain things which are general we can understand in that framework and understand the structure of what you might expect in more general things, more general situations. So this doubling of degrees of freedom is powerful because it allows you to describe all sort of non-equilibrium phenomena and dissipation and all these things. It's also very dangerous, as I will explain, because you run into issues. You have to be very careful about your theory staying unitary in such things. So for those of you having seen my talk last week, you've seen a very explicit example of this danger of doubling, where I wrote down a hydrodynamic theory and I just naively doubled the degrees of freedom. And I was immediately able to write down an effective action for that theory which violates the second law, which is something similar to, like, as a statement that I violate unitarity. Okay? And we see other examples today of this. Okay, so now let's look at hydrodynamics, because this is somehow very generic. It's a very universal description of a particular sector of low energy physics. I mean, the sector where fluctuations somehow are not too big. You stay reasonably close to equilibrium, and fluctuations happen only on large scales. So I will have to explain some features of the structure of hydrodynamics to set the stage of what I'm doing. And then in part two, will be a general discussion about Schwinger-Keldysh path integrals and features thereof. And then in the last part of my talk, I will formulate a gauge theory of entropy, which comes out of the Schwinger-Keldysh ideas, and sketch how to get a complete effective action description of hydrodynamics. Okay, so let me be very, very brief about what hydrodynamics is, just to tell you. So I want to think of hydrodynamics as the generic near equilibrium effective field theory for long wavelength fluctuations. Okay, and in general for systems in mixed states. Right, so you start with your favorite microscopic theory, and at large length scales, larger than some typical mean free path or inverse temperature or something like that, you don't see the microscopic degrees of freedom anymore, but all you see is some macroscopic fluid variables and a background source, say. So fluid dynamics is really the theory of this, the theory of a vector field beta in a background. And this vector field beta is basically, it tells you the direction of the fluid flow. And it's normalized by the temperature. Okay, so this is all you see at the macroscopic scale. And it's been known for a long time that the phenomenological framework to describe such theories is by postulating some energy momentum tensor, which is just a functional of beta and g of these fields. You can expand that order by order in derivatives. Okay. Hydrodynamics is a derivative expansion. And then the dynamics of the theory is just conservation. So that's just what you do. And so the simplest example would be at zeroth order without any derivatives, the most general tensor with two symmetric indices that you can build has this form. So there are two tensor structures at lowest order. One describes energy density, the other one pressure. And then you can play this game at any arbitrary order in derivatives, and it gets more and more complicated. And on top of this framework, you impose a second law of hydrodynamics, if you wish. So you impose on these constitutive relations, on this expansion of the energy momentum tensor, you impose a second law which says that there's an entropy current, which is also given as a derivative expansion. At lowest order, it's just an entropy density which flows with the fluid, the direction of the fluid, and then there are higher order corrections. And this entropy current has to have positive definite divergence on shell. So if you impose these equations motion. Okay. So this implements the second law in this framework. And this constraint, because it's an on-shell constraint, it gives you all sort of constraints on this expansion. Okay, these get more and more complicated at higher orders. So at very low orders, you just get thermodynamic identities. Then you get statements such as viscosities have to be positive definite. And at higher orders in derivatives, you get more and more constraints. Okay, so this is a problem you can try to solve. You can ask what's the most general thing you can write here, the most general tensor structure with these dynamics, and such that the second law is satisfied. And this problem we solved earlier this year, and we found that you can solve this entropy constraint, and you find that there are eight classes of it's useful to organize the allowed things into eight classes of allowed transport, which is allowed by the second law and which is consistent with the second law. And one of these classes, the one in the middle, being the dissipative class, and everything else is non-dissipative. And we gave an algorithm which constructs all this transport at any order in derivatives explicitly, such that the second law is implemented automatically. You don't have to worry about imposing equations of motion and all that. And whatever this algorithm does not produce is the kind of energy momentum tensors which you could write down by symmetry, but which are just forbidden by the second law. Okay. So we have a structure here, which is that's kind of the message that there's a question.
So are those eight exclusive things, or are they things that can be added up?
So these eight things, they classify what you can write down here and what's allowed by the second law.
So you can.
You can add all of them together to get the most general thing here,
okay.
but each term belongs into one of these classes, mm-hmm. up to field redefinitions and subtleties like that. But, yeah. Good. So last week I explained in detail how this works, but for today all we need to know is that there's a complicated structure or a nice structure if you look at it from some other point of view behind this hydrodynamic framework. And the second law constraint is really the organizing principle behind this classification. And so the interesting thing about this structure is that it's very universal. It describes universal low energy physics in a certain regime. But still, it's very non-trivial. Right? There's a lot of structure which we can try to understand. And we can still understand it. It's not something completely out of the window, but we actually understand how all this works and how everything fits together. So this is a nice testing ground for probing general ideas about non-equilibrium physics. Good. So what's wrong with this framework? The problem is it doesn't make much sense for a field theorist. Okay? So what I've told you is that your task is to write down energy momentum tensors, then you impose some weird constraint, some inequality constraint, and dynamics is just conservation, and that's supposed to be your theory. But if you want to think of this theory as some universal low energy theory, then what you really want to do is you want to start with some generic Schwinger-Keldysh path integrals and apply methods of effective field theory, right? You want to integrate out high energy modes, and then you end up with some set of fields and symmetries, and you construct the most general effective action allowed by these things, and that defines for you the stress tensor, and the dynamics should also come out of this formulation by symmetries. And where such an inequality constraint comes from, yeah, that's a question I'm going to try to answer in this talk. And also, a dual black hole description should be something somehow natural if you really understand this as a field theorist. It's not clear where there's a dual black hole description in what I've just told you. Okay, so let's try to understand this, how this works as a point of view of Wilsonian field theory. Well, it is, sure. But I'm just saying the way I set up the problem, that you do this phenomenological building blocks and stick together things, that's doesn't really know about ADS. So. Okay. So this is the last bit of repetition, because this is important for what I want to say. That so say we want to try to formulate such an effective field theory for this framework, then the most naive thing you can do is just take the fields that I told you about so far, the fluid vector and the background source, and build some Landau-Ginzburg effective action out of these fields, which is, and as a symmetry, you just impose that this is a scalar, which you build in a covariant way, so it's diffeomorphism invariant. Okay, so that's maybe the first thing you might try to do. And once you have such an action, it defines for you an energy momentum tensor by variation with respect to the metric, the source. And if you vary with respect to the other field, you get some other object, H. And we've shown that if you also define an entropy current from this action by taking this this Euler derivative with respect to temperature to get an entropy density, then this defines for you an entropy current. And you can actually check that the entropy current defined this way and the energy momentum tensor defined this way provides a solution to the second law constraint. Okay? So
this constraint is equal.
It's a non-discipline. Yeah. So I'm not saying this solves the whole thing. I'm just saying if you construct such actions, whatever it defines for you is consistent with the second law. So it's fine. This construction is somehow okay. Mm. But on top of this second law constraint, you want to ask, is the dynamics of this theory, is it just conservation or is it more? And it is just conservation if you think about it from the right perspective. So I have not told you yet what is exactly the dynamics of this field beta. And the right way to do it, it turns out, is by thinking not about beta being the degree of freedom, but by thinking about this hydrodynamics as a sigma model. Okay, so you have some sigma model maps X, which maps some reference configuration or some world volume theory into some sigma model space, into some space filling brain. Okay, so the physical fluid lives here on this brain or in this space filling brain, but it is really the image of in a sigma model sense of some world volume theory. And all the fields which live here, this beta and this G, so in particular beta, it is really the push forward of some reference configuration beta living on the world volume. Okay, the push forward by this sigma model map X. And similarly, something similar story for the metric. Or maybe another way to think about this is this now looks a bit like ADS CFT. Okay, you could imagine that this is that you somehow map between the horizon and the boundary fluid, And these X's are the maps which take you between those.
I thought the metric was supposed to be bigger.
Yeah, so, right. So the G here is not dynamical.
Yes.
But this means the G down here is dynamical. Mm-hmm. So this G. Yeah, exactly. So this beta is dynamical because of the axis, because it comes from some non-dynamical beta via a dynamical map. And for the metric, it works the other way around. The metric is a background here, but it's dynamical here. And if you now vary the action I gave you before with respect to these pullback maps, these axes, then it turns out the equations of motion corresponding to that are just conservation of the energy momentum tensor I showed you before. Okay?
And what about the equations of variation with
respect to the dynamical metric? Well, you do the dynamical fields in this theory are just the axis now.
Okay.
So if you only look at this world, it looks like the metric is dynamical, but
okay.
But this is just because of X. Yeah. It's some vector living down here, which doesn't have dynamics. It's just some reference fluid flow, say. Yeah.
So it could be just going in time.
Yeah, you could gauge fix it to be just a time-like vector, which
okay.
is just that. Yeah. Yeah. Okay. So the lesson here is just that you can write these naive actions, and if you think of them as a sigma model, then you get some subsector of hydrodynamics. Okay, so hydrodynamics somehow wants to be a sigma model of such X maps. But are we done now? Is this a complete Lagrangian theory of hydrodynamics? No. So the answer is no. I showed you in the beginning this wheel with eight classes of allowed transport. It turns out the construction I just showed you captures two of those. Okay. So there's a lot is still missing. So somehow this is not the whole story. But it gives us some idea of what should be involved in the whole story. So now the question is how to get the remaining six classes, in particular, how to think about dissipation. Okay. And before I go into Schwinger-Keldysh, let me give you a preview of what the answer is going to be. So we want to formulate a sigma model of some kind where the dynamical fields are these x's. And one more remark on this type of theory. You can ask in this particular Lagrangian class of theories, what's the Noether current for diffeomorphisms along this vector that we have? And it turns out this Noether current is basically just the entropy current. Okay. That's just a fact about these Lagrangian classes of theories, but we want to elevate this fact to a much stronger statement. So the proposal for the final theory is that what you should do to this sigma model is you should understand this Noether current really as a symmetry current of some independent symmetry, meaning we will do something like gauging these thermal translations, these translations along this thermal vector. This will give rise to a gauge symmetry, which emerges in this macroscopic description. And the second claim will be that I should supersymmetrize this whole construction. And the supersymmetry I have in mind is this NT equals 2, which is a twisted supersymmetry, which first showed up in work by Waffa and Witten, where they did a topological twist of N equals 4 super youngness.
So you call it supersymmetry, but it's very same kind of BST symmetry.
Yes, yeah, it's a topological thing. Yeah. It has two supercharges. Yeah. And the claim is that it will give you everything we saw in this classification at any order and derivatives, and nothing more. It will not give you anything that violates the second law. Okay, and this sounds a bit crazy at this point because it's saying that there's this kind of topological symmetry, and there's an emergent gauge symmetry, and all these things behind every relativistic fluid. Okay, so let me justify these statements and try to explain why we think that this is what should happen. And this takes me to this chapter about Schwinger-Keldysh formalism, where we can forget about hydrodynamics for a minute. Okay. I want to, in particular, talk about three features of Schwinger-Keldysh formalism. The first one is the most familiar one, which is the doubling that I already mentioned. Okay, so Schwinger-Keldysh formalism means that in your path integral, you have a funny time contour, which kind of runs all the way to infinity or beyond the latest operator insertion, and then it comes back, and then goes down a bit. So here it goes down by a thermal period. So this is like a thermal initial condition with some periodicity, and then you evolve independently two copies of the system, in some sense. Okay, so this is like taking the bra and the cat of your mixed state and keeping track of them independently, evolving both of them. And the real Hilbert space of your theory should then be something where you take two copies of your original theory.
Does this picture mean that is a path integral made on half space time? Because it goes from zero to. So
yeah, we can, let's say we focus on some time interval, t initial to t final, during which things happen, during which I turn on sources. So say whatever happens before, I start at some time turning on sources and keep track of what the sources do to the system. And at some final time, the sources, I switch off the sources, then I can come back.
I mean, if you want to think about this, I think they have two copies of the theory. I guess it's not just I think they have on that pick number one. Otherwise, they just wouldn't talk to each other.
Right. They, yeah.
Are you putting a boundary condition in time equal to zero? Or, I mean, time, some initial time.
Yeah. So, what I have in mind here, this vertical piece is the initial time at which I have a boundary condition, which I will take to be a thermal boundary condition.
Okay. And then you don't know anything.
I can just evolve. And in hydrodynamics, it will assume that I don't evolve too far away from equilibrium. But in general, I can just do this. And now, it has also been understood in the 60s by Feynman and Vernon that if you do such a setup and you integrate out high energy modes from some Schwinger-Keldysh path integral, then the low energy modes start talking to each other. Okay, so you get something that's called influence functional. Which just means that these two copies of the theory, they're not just independent copies, but they start coupling to each other. And this is what makes this formalism powerful, because it allows you to describe things like dissipation. But it's also what it makes it dangerous, because it's very easy once you let the two copies talk to each other to write down things that are not unitary. Okay. And this is really an important problem for systematically understanding non-equilibrium physics. Okay, so this is the doubling. Now let's see what else this doubling does for you. So I've shown you this time ordering prescription, which just says that you have one copy of the theory where operator insertions are time ordered in the usual way, and then you have another copy where insertions are anti-time ordered. So this prescription comes with a particular Schwinger-Keldysh time ordering. You can write down a generating function of this, which looks like this, right? So you can almost immediately translate this into the contour. So you have this U of right sources evolves you forward in time. The U dagger of left sources evolves you backward, and the rho zero, that's my initial condition here, which we will just assume is a, for instance, a thermal initial condition. Okay, so a Schwinger-Keldysh generating functional looks like this, and you can now compute all sort of correlators by differentiating this with respect to the different sources, the J right and the J left sources. And now, from writing it this way, you can immediately see that there's a certain limit when I put the sources to be equal, where this just localizes to a trace over the initial condition, assuming that these evolution operators are unitary. Okay, because there's a trace. So if I take the limit, or if I look at the sector of the theory where I only look at sources which are equal, then the theory is topological in some sense. Because if I set them equal, this means the only thing, this means I'm setting to zero the difference sources, j right minus j left. So I'm left with the common sources, j right plus j left, if you wish. And what they source is exactly the difference operators. Yeah? So this particular sector of the theory only knows about the correlation functions of difference operators, operators on the right minus operators on the left contour. And
can I think about it as a statement that the state you're putting in initial time is annihilated by the difference?
Right. Well, I mean, yeah.
Not annihilated.
I'll have some annihilation statements in the next slide. Yeah. So at this point, I just want to think of this as saying that there's a protected sector, there's a topological sector in the theory where correlation functions just vanish. or more generally, if I don't normalize this, then correlation functions would be independent of where I insert the operators. So be topological in that sense. So these correlation functions, they don't know anything about the dynamics of the theory. They only know about the initial condition, rho zero. Okay, so this is just a theory of boundary conditions now. And the question is, how do we keep track of this feature along RG, say? Because we now have a symmetry, and we should keep track of this and say what happens to this. The proposal is this. So we have a topological symmetry if we're in the sector where we only source difference operators. And what went into this was unitarity, right? This only worked because U and U dagger cancel here if I set the sources equal. So this topological symmetry is really a manifestation of the unitarity of the theory. And yeah, as you mentioned before, this is like BRST now, that BRST quantization, we know how to keep manifest all of the symmetries of a theory. So you don't want to explicitly fix the gauge, but you keep track of all the symmetries, which means you keep also track of the redundancy in the theory. And the way you do this in BRST quantization is you introduce ghosts, which sort of soak up this redundancy. And we want to do the same thing here. So we want to introduce ghost degrees of freedom. So we had O right and O left operators. And now I also want to introduce a Grassmann odd counterparts of these guys, a ghost and an anti-ghost, in this BRST sense, such that I can keep manifest this topological symmetry, and the ghosts make sure I'm not overcounting things. Okay, and as in BRST quantization, I now have two topological charges, I call QSK and QSK bar, which implement this cohomological structure. So in particular, these topological things, these difference operators, they are sitting at the bottom of some cohomology now, which is nice, right? So these are now the Q and Q bar exact objects. This diagram just means that if I act with QSK on one of these guys, I get a ghost. If I act on the ghost with QSK bar, I land in the topological sector. Okay. So now I have a control. I can now control the feature of this theory that I have a topological sector, and I control it in a way that's formulated in such a way that it should somehow survive RG, okay? Because it's a symmetry, it's a topological thing. Okay, does this make sense so far? Good. So making sure that this structure, this cohomological structure, is there also later on also in the macroscopic coarse-grained hydrodynamic description. That's saying I do RG and I keep track of unitarity. In particular, hydrodynamics should later also have such a topological limit.
You're saying that the structure is built in the Twitter public suspension.
Yeah, so this was completely generic. For any Schwinger-Keldysh path integral, you have this structure.
You have added extra things.
Yeah, that's my question. Well,
OK.
I mean, whether these other operators are just tracked on the fields in the theory, or add them to the theory?
Well, I'm adding them on top of this. So so this is a standard thing, this slide. And here is the proposal is the most natural way for a field theorist to keep track of this standard thing is by introducing ghosts and postulating this structure. Well, then. Then I don't know how to do it. That's the point. So these ghosts allow me to keep the symmetry manifest and keep track of it.
So these ghosts are just copies of the elementary. Two more copies of the elementary field with different statistics.
Yeah, with a different Grassmann parity. Yeah.
So if I add them, don't I change the answer? I mean, I'm not saying happens. I'm saying, is it obvious that the path integral of this four set of fields will still give me the
A. Well, we have to construct it in such a way that this works, yeah. But the claim is it does. Yeah. The claim is there is a construction where imposing this structure is exactly the right thing to do. And the hydrodynamic is a nice framework because I can really test what I mean by the statement that it exactly works, because I understand very well the structure of hydrodynamics and the constraints and so on. So if I can reproduce all this intricate structure from this, then that's
but you're not saying that if you don't introduce these additional freedom, then that's not
well, if I don't introduce these things and just double, then I can immediately violate the second law in hydrodynamics.
Right. When you write the back.
Yeah.
The original doubled theory is fine.
That's what I
was saying. Yeah. So I want to figure out what are the low energy fields and what are the low energy symmetries. And the statement is I should have these things.
But so
at the level of the microscopic theory, these fields, it's additional that you don't follow from the microscopic.
Yeah, they're very natural to introduce because, yeah.
No. Like if you take the path integral, right, only then start integrating out, then you're saying that in the end, you should derive at this time.
Yeah, I mean, you can gauge fix this whole structure and get rid of the ghosts. So that's what we often do.
So there was there's an extra gauge symmetry here. That somehow
at this point, there's just a topological symmetry. But the thing is that I want to keep this symmetry manifest.
Understand what I'm saying. So in the UV, you can write an action, I think, for these four things, which can be gauge fixed to the SK.
Yeah. I think you can say it that way. Yeah, because so it's like in BRST, you can always go to some particular gauge fixing and get rid of the ghosts.
Yeah, but when I do BRST, because I have a gauge symmetry and I want to gauge fix. Do you have a gauge symmetry in the SK?
Not yet. No. So at this point, we just have this topological symmetry.
Which is the same. So the theory with this symmetry. How do you know that it's equivalent to the original SK theory?
Well, I mean, at this point, I'm postulating things. I'm saying let's see where this takes us and that it actually works. But
if I do a calculation with this theory in the UV before I write effective actions,
uh-huh.
Do I get the right answer? Do I get the thermal?
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, yeah. Okay, what do you want to compute? You can compute correlation functions,
yes, exactly.
From this thing.
So the correlation function of some ORs and OLEFs, but in the extended theory. Is it the same thing as doing them with this, as doing the Z escape function?
Yeah, so in this limit where you have the topological symmetry.
No, in general.
Well, before you take this limit, there's no symmetry, right? So this topological symmetry arises in the limit where you.
But I'm saying, suppose I take a correlation function of a bunch of ORs and OLEFs. I compute it in this theory, or I compute it in this extended theory. Do I get the same answer?
You get the same answer because the you get the same answer, and the things which are zero, you will get.
Not the things that are zero, just you get the same answer.
You get the same answer, yes.
Okay. Yeah. Is it obvious? Or is it that? I mean,
something
that I should recognize immediately?
Or I mean, most of. I mean, your right and left fields are still the same fields, right, as before.
Yeah, so I understand that there will be a part integral over these Gauss fields multiplying everything. I guess it will cancel out of potential function. But I'm worried about it in the symptom. Big zero.
I think you correlate it at the top and the bottom there.
Yes. The same, you cancel out of ratios.
Yes. Yeah, yeah, okay.
So what is the observable term? Which cause number is there still?
The things you want to observe in the end of the day is still the same correlators as before.
Zero.
Yeah. We will. Unusual. Okay, but let's see where this structure takes us, and I will give some examples to justify where this structure is sensible in just a bit. Yeah, more or less that. Yeah. Okay, but before I do that, let me talk about one more feature of this particular time contour, or more precisely about the boundary condition of the string occasion path integral. So let's now look at really a thermal initial condition. And if you stay in thermal equilibrium, if the system is just in thermal equilibrium, you have a Euclidean periodicity, or a better way to say it in this context is that you have a KMS condition, which relates an operator at some time to the operator where you do a finite translation along the thermal direction, an imaginary thermal direction. Okay, so I can define for every operator, I can define an O tilde, which is related to the operator by this thermal translation. And in equilibrium, these are just exactly the same thing, but as this KMS condition. So the discussion I just gave about correlation functions and topological sector, I can just repeat this discussion and replace, for example, every left operator by left tilde. And
you can rotate by I beta a single operator, leaving all the other ones untouched.
As long as the KMS condition exactly holds, you can do that, because rotating by I beta doesn't do anything. So this is really in equilibrium, where you don't have the features we're going to be after. But in this situation where you stay in equilibrium, you would conclude that there's a second sector of these KMS rotated difference operators, which also have this kind of symmetry. Okay, so I could do a similar construction and say that in global thermal equilibrium, I have a second such sector, and I can write down a similar structure where, again, the topological observables are now sitting at the bottom of some cohomology. And the difference being that these generators QKMS and QKMS bar now, they're also taking you to fields of other Grassmann parity, but what they implement is also this thing, this finite, this non-local thermal shift. Okay, so these QKMS really implement finite thermal translations. Yeah, so this is about equilibrium. Yeah. But now let's ask about something that's particular to hydrodynamics, because hydrodynamics is there's still a notion of a local equilibrium. But so the statement of having large fluctuations is that locally you're still in equilibrium, but not globally. Okay. So we're somehow just deformed away a bit from this situation. And at the same time, we are coarse graining and looking at a macroscopic theory. So we're looking at length scales typically larger than the thermal scale. So larger than the scale of non-locality in this algebra. So these operators did a non-local shift, which is of non-local of thermal scale. So if I look at hydrodynamic scales, I'm well above this scale, so it looks more or less local. And the proposal here, and this, I mean, at this point, this is really a proposal, and I will have to justify why this makes sense and that this gives something useful. But the intuition is that in this local equilibrium above thermal scales, this KMS symmetry still approximately holds, and it becomes a gauge symmetry, where these QKMS, these cohomological charges, which in the microscopic description do a non-local thermal shift, in the coarse-grained description they become something local, and the claim is they become really literally the BRST charges of this gauge symmetry. Okay, so this.
Is there some physical name for simple operators like, I don't know, the Wilson line for this UFT?
I don't know at the moment how to think of a Wilson line, but we will see this U1T very explicitly in the field equations later. Yeah.
I mean, it's a rotation, but only
with. I mean, microscopically, in the exactly thermal situation, this is just a Z2.
Yeah.
But yeah, the claim is if you allow local equilibrium and look at large scales, then this Z2 looks like a U1.
I guess you can go by n beta.
You can go.
If you have very large distances.
Okay. So this is just a proposal for what happens to the KMS conditions. So we had a proposal before for there was a topological limit. We said that this topological limit should also be there in the macroscopic description. And similarly, this KMS condition is really a crucial thing, which will make sure your Schwinger-Keldysh path integral is consistent, has the right boundary conditions. So something should happen to it as you cross grain. And the proposal at this point is this is what happens to it. It becomes a gauge invariance. Okay. So now let me justify this with some examples. So the simplest example is just a Brownian particle. Okay, so let's just look at the Brownian motion of some particle at position x. Right, so there may be some force, and in particular, there's a viscous term, some friction proportional to the velocity of the particle, and this n is a stochastic noise. Okay, so by the idea of the fluctuation dissipation theorem, I should relate this dissipative term here to some stochastic noise. So you can think of this as just being a Brownian particle in a fluid, say. We're asking how does it follow the fluid as it's being kicked around. And there's a particular construction which has various names. One of them is MSR construction. How to describe such a system in a Schwinger-Keldysh language. And this just means what I've written here is just a path integral measure which integrates to unity. So I want to study the configuration space of field configurations x, but subject to the condition that I satisfy the equations of motion, and I have the usual determinant, and the noise eventually will be integrated out. I just subject the system to some Gaussian noise. Okay, so I can write this. This is the sensible measure for my path integral description, and I can now play the usual tricks on this.
Sorry? Nu was
New?
New.
That's, yeah?
Now it appears in front of SQL.
Right. So to go from this line to this line, I do several things, which I'm skipping here. So one thing is the delta function. The delta function just becomes I times some Lagrange multiplier times whatever is inside the delta function.
Yeah, but then you add it in your square.
Right, and then there's also the noise coming from here. Mm-hmm. And there's a noise here, a Gaussian noise, which only depends on these noise variables. Yes. And I integrate them out as I go from the first to the second line. Right. I integrate over the noise.
The same new up here. Yeah.
Yeah, so you have something of the form. Okay, so if you exponentiate the delta function, you get something like I. Yeah, you get an I n times the Lagrange multiplier.
Yes, then you get away n, you get an f squared.
And from the Gaussian noise function, you get something like I n squared. Oh, okay, sorry. The Gaussian noise has a width, which is given by the 1 over nu, probably.
Okay, so somehow the nu in the Gaussian noise is the same as the nu in the distribution.
Yeah. So the Gaussian noise by fluctuation dissipation knows about the viscous term. So yeah, that's how. Then you integrate out the noise to this Gaussian integral, which gives you the second term here. And the last term is just the usual Fadiev-Popov trick, where you write the determinant as by using some ghosts, psi and psi bar. And now there are now two superchargers, Q and Q bar, which implement precisely the algebra I showed you before. I didn't show you in detail, but if you write it down in detail, these charges implement exactly that algebra. And you can write this action as a Q bar Q exact object. You need, yeah, right, the n, yeah, that's true. Okay, so the supersymmetry is now manifest because the action is written as some Q bar Q exact object, and what appears inside this Q bar Q exact expression is something very natural that looks like a Lagrangian for the theory, at least the first two terms. And the last term, you see there's a ghost bilinear talking to the noise. That's how this effective action is able to describe dissipation. Okay, we can go one step further if we have. Yeah, let's go one step further with this construction. And so here it's supersymmetric because of these Qs, but let's make this more manifest. Let's make this manifest in a different way by going to superspace. Okay, so we have these two supercharges, and we can make their action manifest by working in superspace and elevating the Brownian particle X to some superfield. Where I now have Grassmann odd coordinates theta theta bar. And these ghosts from the Fadiev-Popov trick appear naturally in this multiplet, and then there's a top component, which is just like a difference field in Schwinger-Keldysh language. And these theta theta bar are just scalars, so I can later on do this in any dimension, and this is the statement that the supersymmetry is a twisted supersymmetry. But, okay. So now this was the action I just shown you with the Q and Q bar. And I can now write this in superspace as a superspace integral where the position of the particle is now a superfield. And okay, there are some covariant derivatives, which I didn't tell you how to define them, but okay. There's some natural way to do this. Okay, so now we have made manifest this supersymmetry. And here's just one more application which immediately pops out of formulating the system in this way. It has been observed by Jarzynski in the 90s. That if you study the CPT properties of this theory, then invariance under CPT gives you this Jarzynski equality, which is this statement, which says that so it relates the work done by the sources to the free energy difference between the initial and the final configuration, right? So this is the free energy difference between initial and final condition, which doesn't know anything about how you go between. So it can be far from equilibrium. And this is an average over all the protocols, how you can go from initial to final condition. So this is a very nice statement because it says that there's an exact statement for physics which can be arbitrarily far away from equilibrium. And you can, from this is more powerful than the second law, you can from this immediately derive a second law in this form. Okay, so in the supersymmetric formulation, this Jarzynski statement or the second law statement is simply the statement that you have invariance under some natural symmetry. Good. So this particle example I want to think of as a toy model for hydrodynamics. Hydrodynamics itself is more complicated, of course. But the rough idea is this, that, okay, I want to remind you that we had an entropy current constraint in the fluid dynamics, which was mysterious from a Wilsonian point of view. We can now already guess that this is probably something like a Jarzynski statement in the supersymmetric language. And I've also told you that this entropy current could be thought of as a Noether current for thermal translations. And these thermal translations are state dependent in the sense that they depend on the temperature, depend on where you are. But this kind of state dependent thermal translations, that's exactly what I was trying to argue is what happens to the KMS condition as you zoom out. So the claim is that this entropy current, which is really a very important but mysterious object in the hydrodynamics, is a current which emerges macroscopically as this U1T emerges as a gauge symmetry. Okay, so out of this KMS, as you go to a coarse grained description, you get a gauge symmetry, and this gauge symmetry comes with a current which is just the entropy current. So we have now a very intimate link between fundamental features of the Schwinger-Keldysh path integral and the entropy current in hydrodynamics, the second law. So the second law is basically I want to think of as a macroscopic version of KMS conditions. And the way to implement this is by having a U1T gauge symmetry where you can. So, let me skip this.
Symmetry in this Langevin.
Sorry?
Can you see an example of this in the Langevin?
You can see it. It's a bit hidden, but if I told you how exactly these Q and Q bar act, you will find that, say, you act with Q squared, what happens is you get a U1T gauge transformation. So you don't get zero, but you get a gauge transformation along this. Okay. There are ambiguities. Yeah. So. Right. In phenomenological hydrodynamics, the game is always to find a entropy current which gives you a second law, and this construction will give you a entropy current, which is. It's ambiguous to some extent because there are field redefinition freedoms and things like that, which will also shift this current.
But the field redefinitions also affect the hydrodynamic stress energy.
They affect everything, yeah.
Even if you remove the field redefinitions, there are.
Right, they're always, always have the ambiguities in this definition. But. I mean, if you think of the entropy current as a one form.
Not only. Exactly.
Yeah. But, I mean, what I still have to show you is that this construction gives us an entropy current for every possible hydrodynamic transport consistent with the second law. And in our earlier papers, we constructed the entropy current, the most general entropy current you can ever get. Up to these ambiguities. And really, this entropy current has to come out of this analysis. And if.
No, but for example, the follow up to this question was saying that you do this analysis for the values of trust. gets sent to the parent. Can you compare the match to the parent with the additional function?
Well, I mean, the ambiguity is in either. Right? Yeah. Okay, let me skip a little bit. And
I mean, would you start to go for it much?
Yeah, but some. What I'm skipping is just saying we were already guessing at an earlier stage, just from hydrodynamics and from the classification. We were already guessing an effective action which implements a U1T gauge symmetry and which gives us the hydrodynamic framework completely. And without explaining too much what this is, you can see there's a gauge field here for some U1 symmetry which couples to a free energy current or entropy current. And this Lagrangian has a particular symmetry which gives you all you want, at least of non-dissipative fluids. And this should come out of this construction. It will be a very non-trivial check. But let me tell you what the construction actually is in the more complicated example of hydrodynamics. So here's the proposal for the hydrodynamic regime that hydrodynamics should be thought of first of all, as a sigma model, as I argued in the beginning, where the fluid degrees of freedom are really sigma model pullback maps, so you can also think of them as the Goldstone modes that come from breaking the two copies of diffeomorphism invariance down to some diagonal copy. Then hydrodynamics, it should come with a topological limit. The limit I explained before should also be visible here. And one can argue that it should correspond to restricting to hydrostatics. So the hydrostatics is like the thermal initial condition. Then you want to gauge this with this U1 symmetry that I argued for. And then you want to deform away, because if it was exactly a topological sigma model, then you would just be in the topological sector in the initial condition. And the dynamic theory should somehow be a continuous deformation of that. So the task is now to formulate this theory in this form and reproduce all of the phenomenological things. And I can tell you some starting point, no time for the full construction, but the basic idea is to do something similar as what I did for the Brownian particle. Take the sigma model map X, the fluid degree of freedom, and make it into a superfield. Similarly, you supersymmetrize everything, right? You get a lot of fields now, so the metric becomes a superfield, and you introduce a one-form super connection for this gauge symmetry, for this U1 gauge symmetry, is a one-form in superspace. And the symmetries are now, so I argued for this supersymmetry with two supercharges. This is now manifest because I'm working in superspace, and I write superspace actions. And the U1 invariance will also be manifest by working in a covariant way with covariant derivatives and all that. And then there's some one things which are natural, like CPT and ghost number conservation. And you can now go and formulate effective actions of this type that I showed before, but in a fully supersymmetric language with all these new ingredients. So the effective action will now be an integral over the whole superspace, the world volume superspace. And here you would write everything that's allowed by symmetries. And the claim is that gives you exactly what you want and nothing else. In particular, it gives you nothing that violates the second law. To just give you one example, the most interesting thing you can do now is you can write down an effective action that describes dissipation. And it takes this form. So, oh no, what's this? Uh-oh. Okay, let's improvise. So the dissipative action is something like the superspace integral. Windows. Right. So you want something that has zero ghost number, So you take the superspace metric, take a covariant derivative with respect to theta, and another one with respect to theta bar. That's okay under ghost number conservation. And now you want to intertwine these two tensors in some way. So you write some tensor which has the right index structure. So it intertwines them. This can contain derivatives and all that. And for those of you who heard my talk last week, I argued that this is tensors of this kind always describe dissipation in hydrodynamics. So actions of this schematic form will give you dissipation. And sorry. Yeah, I'm wrapping up now. There we are.
Remind me, is the bold face met for the this was the ground matter that was kept fixed?
This is the world volume metric.
The one that was kept fixed.
Yeah, this comes from pulling back a target space metric. So target space.
Sorry. So this one, the one with both things, the one that
right.
Pull back on the fixed one.
Yeah, so I can take this and pull it back.
Got it.
Yeah, okay. And maybe one statement to make here is that this is very interesting that we have the current which couples to the U1 gauge field in this action is a symmetry current, it's conserved. And I claim this is the bosonic part of that current is the entropy current. The entropy current is not conserved. But the whole thing being conserved means that the current which couples to the gauge field here also has ghost terms. So what you lose via dissipation, the ghost terms account for that. So you see here quite explicitly how the ghosts being in the theory make sure that all the symmetries are kept manifest. Right. So you can have a second law inequality and still have a conserved current. It's not a contradiction. Because usually we don't talk about the ghosts. And now the
positivity becomes some constraint on some ghost current.
It should. Yeah, we haven't constructed this yet, but the hope would be that the dynamics of the ghosts is such that this inequality comes out of it. Because what we already know is that the bosonic part here, the entropy current you get, is exactly the one we constructed in general.
It diverges the ghost terms because kind of sum squares or something like that.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, that's exactly how it works. Okay, so let me say just a few words about gravity because I mean that would be the ultimate goal that we can now use this machinery and understand something about gravity. And of course, by ADS-CFT, there's an obvious connection between dissipating fluids and the horizons of large ADS black holes. And we saw in hydrodynamics, we had enough control to really make it clear that this doubling and the ghosts and the supersymmetry and all that is really crucial to understand what's going on and to get a field theoretic understanding of the phenomenological framework. So, question is, all these features, what do they tell us about gravity? Where? Of course, in gravity, people run into very similar confusions that somehow effective field theory seems to be in conflict with unitarity and things like that. And in hydrodynamics, at least, we understand that to understand what's going on, you need to keep track of the microscopic symmetries and the ghosts kind of save the day. And finally, so black hole entropy for stationary black holes, Wald entropy is just a Noether charge of a particular kind of translation. And there's a very similar concept as what I've told you in fluid dynamics, that fluid entropy is now the Noether charge of some thermal translation of some kind. But this is now off equilibrium and off stationarity, so perhaps one can use this to gain insight into the what's black hole entropy in general. Okay, so that's the summary. It's just a list of all the features I argued for, all the features which are natural from field theory point of view and which should somehow be there in any Schwinger-Keldysh problem. And yeah, and all this should eventually be questions about gravity. Thank you. Thank you. Yeah.
Do you know where the gauss would come from?
Well, if you do gravity, say, some typical horizon physics of gravity, you know there are also two copies, right?
Yes.
So this is really a Schwinger-Keldysh problem, although it's usually not traced that way.
The claim
is having two copies means that if you want to make sure that what you're doing at low energies is unitary and satisfies the right boundary conditions and so on. Should be ghosts, and you can, maybe there's a way to gauge fix them to be all zero, but then unitarity of your description is not manifest anymore. So perhaps this tells us.
To
get rid of the ghosts?
To produce them.
Yeah, so this is a challenge which we're working on to formulate a gravitational theory with all these features. I don't know how this plays out, but the fact that the Schwinger-Keldysh discussion was completely general says that there should be some way of doing this. And probably the fluid gravity correspondence will be a good way to start. And the ghost should really have to do something to do with entropy of the black hole and dissipation. So this idea that what gets lost in the black hole, the ghosts somehow keep track of it. And at least that's the picture which seems natural from a hydrodynamics point of view.
Do you think they would live somehow behind the horizon?
I don't know how to think of the. Most ambitiously, one could try to understand black hole interior in terms of these ghosts.